Welcome to Season 4 of the Chai Brave Podcast. This is your invitation to grab a cup of piping hot chai and get ready for chaivizations that nourish the soul and inspire your everyday. This season, we're diving deep into the world of sustainable living. More than ever, we need to find ways to live in harmony with our planet. So throughout the season, I'll be talking to climate tech entrepreneurs, exploring practical tips from experts, and uncovering the joy of living a life that's good for you and good for Mother Earth. Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Chai Break Podcast. As we all know, we're in a race against climate change here. And in this climate marathon, technology has clearly emerged as one of the most powerful allies. From renewable energy to carbon capture, innovative solutions are paving the way forward toward a more sustainable future. And at the core of all these efforts are the four R's of sustainability: reduce, reuse, recycle, and recover, each of which plays a unique role in mitigating environmental impact. But perhaps the most crucial one is reduce, the idea of minimizing our carbon footprint from the start. And guess what? My guest today is doing exactly that. Meet Joita Das, the co-founder and CEO of Samudra Oceans, a visionary leader in UK's deep tech landscape. With over a decade of experience and multiple Ivy League qualifications, she has founded three successful startups and serves on the boards of global companies, passionately advocating for the use of technology to drive social good. Joita has been recognized as an Innovate UK Women in Tech Ambassador, featured in the Financial Times BAME list of 100, and honored with the UK Pioneering Women in Tech Award from Diversity UK. Her influence as a speaker extends to prestigious platforms like the UN, the World Economic Forum, and the Scottish Seaweed Industry Association. Most recently, she was part of a UK delegate mission to Canada for Oceans with the Global Business Innovation Programme, furthering her commitment to sustainable innovation and global collaboration. And on that climate positive note, welcome to the Chai Break Podcast, Joita. I am so excited to have this chaivization with you.
Thank you so much for having me, Shweta, and saying all those kind words. You're pretty awesome yourself, and I'm really glad Manya introduced us, and I'm very excited and honored to be here.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, with your bio and everything we've spoken about, it's clear you're passionate about technology. Your early career, though, started off in a bunch of big tech companies, both in India and the Silicon Valley. So I'm very curious, tell us a little bit about those early years and how you transitioned into the world of startups and hence entrepreneurship. What was that driving factor, that common thread that kind of led you to where you are today?
I think it's a really good question because it's hard to put an exact finger on it. But if I were to look back and join the dots, I'll say, I think I was always entrepreneurial in the sense that I struggled to just respect status quo just because everyone said so. I wanted to understand, does it serve the purpose that we are after? And if there's a better way to do it, why won't we? Like, don't fix what's not broken wasn't really my mantra. But I would say that they did play a very positive role in a slightly different way. I think some of the first companies I worked in, regardless of the usual stuff people say about how corporate tech has like taken their soul and whatever, regardless of all of that, the positive has stayed with me. I've had incredible people who mentored me, managed me over leadership, and I learned some fundamental principles of leadership from them that I still use today, like an open door policy or trying to be as flat as possible in a big hierarchy to encourage innovation. So I learned a lot. And it also kind of, I think, brought me to a global platform because they were global corporates. They would pay for my travel. I traveled to endless countries, sometimes two countries in a week, to complete my assignments. And that just basically meant that I had covered 30 countries in five-star accommodations and chauffeur-driven cars in my early 20s, trying to go and manage and lead products and projects, which gave me the confidence I needed to operate on a global stage. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that pushed me towards startups wasn't necessarily startups. I actually didn't even know I want to be a founder. So I can't even say that, oh my God, I grew up thinking I'll be an entrepreneur. Not at all. I grew up thinking I'll be an engineer. I loved being an engineer. I still do. Many days I wake up and I still feel like an engineer. I really still am an engineer. That's how I think. That's how my brain is structured. I think what pushed me towards startup was I was looking for a mechanism to contribute to an ecosystem where I'm able to contribute a lot more than I was doing at the time. Mm-hmm. I knew I had a lot to give and I felt kind of constricted that I wasn't able to give in a way that I wanted to. Like my impact and my magnitude of impact was greatly diminished. So I felt like if I was in a place where I was allowed to do a lot more, here are the things I would do. Now, one might say that almost everyone wants that. Everyone wants to do more. I don't think that's entirely true, because if you want to do a lot more, it comes with a lot more responsibility and a really hard life that we're not all prepared for. But I was prepared for. I knew what that meant. But I wasn't getting the opportunity to do that. So when the first startup came my way, I was actually a technical co-founder there, not the CEO. So kind of more like the CTO. I took the opportunity and I just jumped on board. And that had an exit and the rest is history. I just kept on continuing. Mm-hmm. I think even today, the honest truth is I'm not necessarily married to the mechanism of impact. Startup, corporate, nonprofit, blog, I don't care. Mm-hmm. I'm married to the output. This seems to be the output that I'm able to achieve with my skill sets and opportunity in front of me. If today the world changes drastically and there are other vehicles, I don't know, neurotelepathic movies to influence people and put new ideas, I don't know, then maybe in that new world, I'll accept a new paradigm. Mm-hmm.
That's so fascinating. I really love your thought process and your perspective on these things. Now, before we dive into all things Samudra and sustainability, I have to ask, from an engineering major now to Samudra, through and through, being a woman, you've been in a male-dominated industry. So I'm curious to know, and I'm sure our listeners are too, about the unique challenges and how you chose to navigate them.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, sincerely, I've been in not just a male-dominated room, but a room full of 90% men since the day I started my career. Uh-huh. Every single day in electronics engineering, in software, in AI, in investment, in boardrooms, in founders, as deep tech founder, and now climate. There is never a room where there's enough women. Not even 20%. It's always 5, 10%, probably single digits. Mm-hmm. And it has not always been very easy. A, there is the usual question of the biases, sure. But there's a second thing that happens. There's a neurological load that builds up on a human when they don't find like-minded people or see them for a very long time. Okay. Like if to all the men listening out there, imagine you're in a room full of women working with them, having coffee with them, going to the water cooler with them, getting in the lift with them, listening to their conversations, going to their nail salons and spas and their sports as well, and doing that every day for the next 14 years of your life. Every day, a room full of women, and you're the only guy. Try doing that. I've done the equivalent of that. So there's been a huge neurological load, which has been like, where are my girls? So, you know, I don't think I've managed to navigate it as, or anyone can. It's just like, it's a crisis situation. How do you navigate a crisis? You have coping strategies. Mm-hmm. I think the coping strategy for me was I always tried to find allies within those groups and they would accept me in a way which wasn't like demonized or idolized, but as peers. And that was great. I think the second way I chose to navigate is make way for others, you know, like pull up other women and give them an opportunity to join me, give them an opportunity to join the things that I wasn't even in, but I can influence. And going further, having a messaging for women in general, in all age groups, to know that you could be part of any room if you wanted to. It's a bit harder for us because they haven't seen us yet, but you can do it. Mm-hmm. So basically, and those things relieved my neurological load, kind of a bit like climate crisis. If you're feeling very anxious, but you end up doing something about the climate, you feel a bit better. You're like, I did something.
Yeah.
So I felt that way. The rooms still haven't changed. Deep tech does not have women. It still does not have enough. And we still don't live in a world where deep tech entrepreneurship is very comfortable for women. Forget leadership, not even to enter as an individual commuter. And as women leaders, definitely it's highly lacking. I hear that it's changing. It just hasn't changed enough. I think we're all very pleased with the fact that, oh, it's changing. But it's just, I don't think it's fast enough, given how fast, look at the evolution of information technology. Look at the evolution of computer speed. Look at how cars went from speed to electronics, everything. The things we focused on, we really turned them on. The world is unrecognizable. But this one thing is moving at snail speed because I don't think the men still identify it as a huge urgency or a crisis, which is pretty sad. And neither do most women, by the way. They're also pretty happy with the snail speed. So I don't think I've navigated it well. I still feel frustrated about it. That's the long story short.
But I think in the bigger picture, yes. But I think, like you said, right, you're doing something about it, like opening doors for more women and influencing them and bringing them in wherever you can. So that's a great start.
Yeah, massively. There are listeners out there. I would like them to know that I do have a forum for women founders across the world that I've been running for about 6-7 years. It's mostly on WhatsApp. It's zero hierarchy because I didn't want cocktails and selfies. I wanted original conversations. Mm-hmm. And so if you are up for it, if you're a woman founder anywhere in the world, I will add you. Just reach out to me. I also mentor girls in STEM who are under the age of 16 or 18, trying to figure out what kind of careers they can have. And I occasionally have spoken at Marie Curie fellowships. Like, basically, if you want me to reach out and help you because you're a woman who finds herself in a minority situation, which most likely all of you do, then you can reach out and we can try and find a way together.
That is fabulous. That is so amazing. I'll be sure to share this information even on our social media channels. That's awesome. Now, coming to Samudra, tell us how you got started with Samudra and what was your why? And what inspired you to specifically choose seaweed farming as your focus?
Yeah, because I didn't want to be happy. I just wanted to sabotage my life. That's why. It seems to be the common thread underlying all my decisions. If I had a therapist, she'd be like, yeah, nodding very like wisely, like this is right. So Samudra is Sanskrit for oceans. And we have a wild OG story. The interesting thing is today is our second anniversary. So it's kind of a very nice day to talk about it.
Oh, that's fabulous. Congratulations.
My baby, that's 2 years old today.
That's awesome.
So 2 years ago, we registered our company in Cambridge, where me and my co-founder we met. We were doing a program in Cambridge for climate where we were thinking of various ideas. And we met on the last day. Or the last week. Basically, it's an opportunity to meet many people and co-found things with them, kind of like a venture builder. Mm-hmm. And I remember that we categorically did not meet each other for the entire duration of the program and teamed up with other people. Like we never spoke to each other. It never happened because we didn't even like, I think he might have tried once, but I didn't even think that it could work because I thought we have the exact same skill set. And we were both looking for complementary people to co-found a company. Because I do A, you do B. That's the idea. Mm-hmm. And he and I are both engineers and quite similar engineers. So I was like, well, this is not going to work. We are hardware engineers. So I need someone else. And he might have thought that. We met towards the end of the program when everyone had teamed up, including him and me. And we kind of like broke our teams to come together. But by the time the program was coming to an end, so we didn't have the time to go through the program together, which was the idea. You ask each other questions. You see, can you do this together? We couldn't do any of that. So we just took a plunge. Like after having said no at the beginning, in the last minute, we said yes. And we went all the way. We were like, well, let's just register because we're running out of time. So we just did that. And it turned out to be a wildly great match. We were like, you know, perfectly suited for each other as co-founders. And so that was the origin story. The reason we chose ocean is I think we are ocean people. I grew up in East India. My co-founder grew up in Jamaica. We currently live in an island nation called the United Kingdom. Very cold oceans here, but it's still surrounded by oceans. And I am a total water baby. Ocean speaks to me. It's not just a place of leisure that I go for holiday. It's the kind of place where I become quiet. And I just, it's everything for me. I once dived in the ocean about 10 years ago. And it was in French Polynesia, in Bora Bora. And I remember going underwater. There's this strange exotic islands over there. And I remember going underwater. And for the first time in my entire life, I felt peace that I've never felt before. There was something that has never happened to me before. It was because in the water, there's not a lot of sound, you know, you just have vision and you have sensory perception. I just knew at that moment that this is the biggest gift we have on this planet. And she's bigger than all of us and more powerful. This is the cradle of life. And people use the water and the seabed to add carbon to the world, which is oil and gas and shipping. And they all had their roles, by the way, which is why civilization came this far. We can't demonize them. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that we've used the water to do terrible things as well. Yeah. And I was like, but this ocean has the power to regenerate, heal, grow. Why don't we use the ocean for the biggest solution in the world, which is to remove carbon? Because she can give life. She can do that too.
Yeah.
And then I thought that, let's look deeper into it. That's kind of like my origin of the ocean story. But it's only when I and Alex met that we looked into it in a structured way and found that the ocean is the biggest heat sink in the world. It produces the maximum amount of oxygen. So 50% of our oxygen is produced in the ocean. And it's also a huge carbon sink. So it is a very scalable solution to the carbon crisis. So all we are doing with technology is not necessarily creating new tech. We are creating tech to assist Mother Nature.
Right.
She already takes out carbon. Mm-hmm. We just want to turbocharge that in certain zones so she can take out a lot more carbon. And that's the idea behind our robotics. It's not just to make cool tech and add carbon to the world, which tech does. When you create it, you add carbon to the world by manufacturing, by whatever, whatever. And we just want to make sure that this goes into a natural ecosystem where it helps take out an outstanding amount of carbon. So it is tech to assist Mother Nature, who's already very good at this, which is turbocharging the timeline.
That's phenomenal. Now, beyond, you know, AI and robotics, to enhance efficiency and the scalability of seaweed farming. Beyond all of that, something you'd also do at Samudra and believe is the tertiary effect on both biodiversity and the coastal communities. Talk us through that.
The tertiary effects are very powerful as well. One of my worries with very powerful nature solutions almost always is, well, what else happens when you work with nature, right? Mm-hmm. We're living in the age of the Anthropocene, which all anthropologists will tell us. You know, before this, we were in Geocene, Holocene, there were various ages. We live in an age of the Anthropocene where anthropologically, it's the first time that humankind has made marks on this planet that are not erasable. Like the half-life of that is beyond humanity. Mm-hmm. Until this time, we weren't able to negatively impact the planet in such a big way that it cannot recover. But we've managed to do that, which is why it's called Anthropocene, because, you know, anthropologically, we've altered it forever. So if you look at the sign of how much ice we've lost in the Arctic circles or the half-life of the nuclear waste that we've embedded, they all exceed the half-life of habitable planets. So we've altered it forever. So we're living in a very powerful age, which basically means that human beings now have the technology to alter things beyond their repairing capability by many, many, many times, which is the origin of our crisis, climate crisis. Mm-hmm. So it is very natural that when you live with that kind of power, when you try to fix solutions, you might have caused other problems in parallel. So I cannot say 100% with certainty that we are not causing a single problem in the ecosystem. That's the unknown unknown. The known unknown that I can verify is that it does have a huge number of tertiary effects, our technology, which are all very positive for the planet. Mm. So reduction of acidification, reduction of eutrophication, that is removing nitrates that leach into water and happen runoff, which these, you know, algae, they suck up because like plant forms, algae also love nitrate. Yeah. If you put it in crab water, it gets better. The acidity reduces. Huge amount of biodiversity happens because imagine the ocean is like a desert. Where are the animals going to rally? They're going to go where the plants are. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if you have a kelp farm or seaweed growing, that's where the animals grow towards. That becomes their habitat. And when you harvest, if you always leave a little bit behind, that's their home. Mm-hmm. So there's quite a lot of increase of biodiversity. Then there's other ways biodiversity increases. Literally, when a mass grows somewhere, many other ecosystems start flourishing around it. So you have so many things that grow. The most interesting thing that is very well known is baby otters. They use seaweed as a blanket around them because they're not waterproof and they don't know how to swim. So when their moms go hunting, they put them in a seaweed blanket. So it acts as a nursery for them. But you can see baby seals, you can see fish, you can see eel laying eggs, turtles coming to meet the eels. It just becomes a whole thing.
Beautiful.
And then there's a huge part of human well-being here. We help amplify seaweed for carbon capture, but you have to see that it actually means that tier two and tier three coastal towns end up getting an outstanding amount of jobs in this scale, which also plays a big role in the climate thesis, because if they're not always emigrating to the nearest city, It just means that they stay where they are, which and they use their local knowledge to make wealth and bring it to the local economy. And last but not least, the products that CeeWeed itself makes, even if we don't sequester it into permanent carbon, you cannot think of a product it makes that's actually not great. Mm-hmm. So meat substitute burgers, you know, high fiber, high protein, superfood, bioplastics for packaging, biostimulants as a fertilizer. Every single thing replaces something out there that's not good for the planet. So you literally cannot think of something that it does wrong. Mm-hmm. But of course, when you go large scale and you cultivate things, all sorts of things can happen. We are trying to make sure that we are careful by encouraging farmers to not just do monoculture by, you know, lots of things. But I'm pretty sure that we'll discover over time that there might be some side effects we hadn't thought of that are not great. We are never going to close our eyes to it because mm-hmm. we're not a big for-profit corporation right. that's going to bury everything the moment it finds out. No, yeah. we're in love with the planet. So if you tell me I've done three things that are wrong for the planet, I will fix it. Because mm-hmm. my biggest goal here is how we all fix the nature crisis, right. not how we can become only the most profitable company in the world. So we will fix it and we will move forward. So we keep our eyes open and we are constantly looking at data. But so far, we haven't seen anything greatly detrimental. The tertiary effects seem pretty cool, actually.
That's awesome. That's really great to hear. Now, obviously, with everything that you've been describing, right, when it comes to entrepreneurship, one of the biggest hurdles a lot of people face, and especially with an industry like ocean tech and the landscape of securing investment. I'd love to hear your story. I ask all of my entrepreneur guests this, and it's always kind of exciting to hear and how they navigate it and what are the unique challenges they faced. And especially when you're also thinking of this large scale undertaking and with plans to keep growing.
Yeah, really good question. We did raise quite a bit. I raised quite a bit in my last few companies as well. I've also been a fundraising advisor for a while, even for bigger Series A, B companies. And I'm on the board of quite a few companies who are raising themselves. Mm. So I've always been in the thick of it. Mm-hmm. I also am advisor to a couple of funds and investment committees. So I'm on the other side of the table as well. Mm-hmm. So raising has always been in my radar forever. And the way I think about it is, if you take a step back, I generally think that any action that you talk about that an entrepreneur needs to do, this may sound a little bit esoteric and like glamorizing it, which I'm not a big fan of, but I generally think that to be entrepreneurial and to take that level of risk taking, you're not just playing with a project, you're playing with your life. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the way you lead your life itself has to be a bit different from everyone else. All your decisions, personal and professional, aren't going to look like anyone else's decision. And that means that you're fundamentally a risk taker because you're not aligning to that decision-making right. process at all, right? Mm-hmm. You're not aligning to anything that is considered a safety box by a lot of people. Not anything that's a majority. Because if you want to achieve something that no one else has done before, your actions should look like something that no one else has done before. Mm-hmm. Same action, same output, you see?
Yeah.
So if I apply that, I would say fundraising is the same thing. If you're going to approach it like any classical old-fashioned or what is called fundraising in the world, I think it won't work because you start to get very personal. You start to look at it as a reflection of capability, which is what most humans do when they do any action. That's not what fundraising is. It's a very impersonal endeavor. There are biases. There's no doubt. There are people at the other end who are not treating you fairly. But there are also 1 in 1,000 people who are treating you fairly. The problem is you'll miss that 1 in 1,000 if you focus just on the 999. So you do want to make a noise about it. Mm-hmm. Sure. Mm-hmm. Don't want them to get away. But there's a time for it. Maybe after the races. Or maybe write it in a diary so you don't forget. Or speak with your girls, yeah. get a drink, yeah. whatever. Yeah. You know. But when you are raising, it is like any other race. It's about numbers. It's about being impersonal. It's about driving the conversation back to what is important. And that would apply to almost everything, by the way. If an entrepreneur starts to use their passion and feeling for the project to drive the external engagements, mm-hmm. it's going to be a problem. Your passion is what drives you.
Yeah.
It's what drives the motivation of the team. It's what keeps you up every night and gets you out of bed. And it's what people need to see to believe in the vision. But it's not what should actually drive the most important endeavors in the business, including fundraising. Mm-hmm. So one advice I give to people is try to bring all conversations back to evidence, analogy, and next steps. So it doesn't matter how you're feeling in the moment. You might have just been faced with a question which you think 100% is wrong or factual or wrong or like, I haven't been treated well here. It does not matter. The only thing you're optimizing in this meeting is the outcome. Okay, forget about it. And I'm not saying suck up to people, never put up with indignity, but just take a step back, be impersonal, and always bring the questions back to like, so what is the next step? Or how would you like to see this better? Mm. Or if you have an answer, provide an answer. Take 5 seconds to write it down in a bullet point and then say it so it doesn't look like you're blabbering. Say, could you give me 5 seconds? I just want to structure my answer. Always looks like a well-prepared person. Always go with a deck that has many appendix slides. So you anticipate questions ahead of time and you can bring them up. It's always easier to bring up a slide and explain than on your own. Mm-hmm. So if you have 30 appendix, I say that's a well-researched meeting. Okay. 40, 50, 100, man. Every question you can think of, put an answer in the appendix so you bring it up. Because mm-hmm. the moment you get into the action of bringing up your slide or looking at your bullet points or saying, so what would be next steps? You're bringing your brain back to center. You're mm-hmm. not pulling yourself in passion. So that, I think, is a really key way and criteria to keep on fundraising a long time in life, which you will if you're an entrepreneur. The second way I would say about to think about fundraising is, and this is where I may deviate from the classical. I know there's a whole Silicon Valley Kool-Aid formula that I did also follow for a while. It's just like, do this, then I get to Series A, blah, blah, blah. But now I say that if you're going to break all molds, why do you have to follow it even for fundraising? Mm. Like, why does it have to be a rule book anywhere? For me, being an entrepreneur meant the freedom to be a first principles thinker, questioning and examining everything. My thoughts, my desires, my feelings, my fears, everything as they are, not as what the world's trying to feed me as, okay? So if you look at fundraising the exact same way, then the question is, why do you have to do Series A? Why do you have to do seed? Why does it have to be VC? Anything's possible. Maybe you're one of those people who really like friends and family and you'd never fight with them. So you want their money, even mm-hmm. though they say no one. Maybe you are one of those people where friends and family will support you because your cousins love you. You have a relationship no one else does in the world. Maybe you don't like that at all. You think you can loan out from your dad who can give it to you and you can return in 5 years. And you have a relationship where you don't mind. Yeah. Or maybe you're a person who thinks that I can do project financing. I can make great decks. I have a background in EY or my partners from McKinsey and we can build this and mm-hmm. get a project. Mm-hmm. Do that. Basically, I think fundraising has become a playbook these days. Mm. And it's starting to get a bit worrying that we are turning entrepreneurship also into an institutionalized, great corporate service, right? Yeah. It's almost like you're measured against it. You didn't raise 5 million seed? Did you not raise 15 million Series A on year 4? Oh my gosh. And I'm like, if that's how you're going to treat entrepreneurship, you've already killed the spirit.
Right.
I'd say navigate fundraising your way. Mm-hmm. Maybe you want to really fast 2 years, then slow 3 years. Maybe you want to go really fast 5 years, then slow for 1 year. Do what works for you mm-hmm. and make it your own toolbox. If it does not fit into the criteria of the best series on the planet, that's not going to kill you mm-hmm. at all. In fact, far from it. So very organically go about it, which basically is me saying there's no formula. Do your own thing.
Right.
And last but not least, is probably a side tip for people. I think that if you have global mobility or global reach, try to look for fundraising across the world. These days, people invest across borders. Mm-hmm. So we all look within our borders, which is always easier because people trust you more, fair yeah. enough. But don't underestimate. You might just get check from someone living in North Canada or Southern New Zealand or Abu Dhabi, which happened to me. Mm-hmm. I've invested across the world. So if you have a reach or a network or a family or a friend or a partner or something, you can reach out to any part of the world. I have a friend. She was fundraising from Japan. And her partner was visiting New Zealand and he had a whole lot of family around there who ended up putting lots of angel checks for her. So, you know what? You just never know. So I would say don't just be restricted by your geography. Reach out globally. There are lots of Asian WIs, angels. You never know. Yeah.
It's such a refreshing perspective. And again, like you said, right? Entrepreneurship as a whole itself is, you know, breaking the mold. So yeah. why follow the rule book at all? Yeah. That's a great, yeah. great way to think about it.
But entrepreneurs yeah. aren't like this these days. I'm like really surprised every day I meet people who are so conforming to what is already considered cool by entrepreneurs. I'm like, this is by definition. Like, why didn't you just go into a corporate job? Because you're pretty much following every single thing. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. look like this. I should behave like this. I should have raised a Series A in year 4. I should have done a seed at a 7x multiple. I'm like, you sound like you're still working. You've never left corporate.
So what is next? What is the next big milestone for Samudra?
So the next big milestone right now is on two levels. At a technological level, we are moving to a complete automation. So instead of automating bits and pieces, we're now looking at automating the entire farm on a large scale. So the whole farm is remotely monitored, remotely managed, lives in the ocean, completely rigged with sensors, and you can whip up your phone and see how it works. So kind of like space station, mm-hmm. you're looking at it ground type of situation. That's happening at the technological level, and we're working hard towards it to deploy probably Q1 next year and then scale it out. Mm. The second level is on a people level. So every company goes through a transition when they start to like burst at the seams and start to scale, and they look for slightly different people than just startup-y people. Mm-hmm. I think for people listening, if anyone's looking to join, I think we are running out of the phase where we are all hiring leadership.
Okay.
Because after this, the teams will start forming around them.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are starting to exceed capacity, where generalists are doing everything, and we are starting to reach more and more of the specialist phase. We're starting to gather around the generalist leaders. Like they always say, you know, the first 10 are the leaders, and mm-hmm. then you have leaders, but they're VPs more than the founder team.
Mm.
So I think we're coming out of the founding team phase from people perspective. But the thing about coming out of the founding team phase, having done it a few times before, is it's a big culture shift.
Mm-hmm.
You go from family style to team style, and then now we're moving on to company style,
right?
Where it's not always games and fun and all deadlines are negotiable internally. It starts to look a bit more, slightly more rigid, not mm-hmm. yet like a corporate, but slightly more rigid.
Okay.
And a lot of people from the beginning are not able to sustain this phase. This is where the massive dropouts happen,
okay.
because people are like, well, this is not why I joined. This feels like a proper job now. Like, and I thought like I had all the flex in the world. So it's going to happen. That's going to happen. And the second thing that affects this transition, or is very critical to it, is I think how the external world perceives you. Because you go from being this very passion-driven, very comes from my home heart project, like numbers, unit economics, profitability type of situation,
yeah, yeah.
which the external world also confuses with like, whoa, what happened? I thought you loved this, but now you're not going to give me a discount. And you're like, well, love won't last forever.
True.
but they will have to see that change and yeah. accept that. I think we will navigate that the next 1 year, this transition. So really focused on that.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Now, coming back to sustainability, what does a sustainable lifestyle look like to you in your everyday life?
You know, one of the biggest things that I always worried about is like, so like, oh, girls, I love fashion and clothes and shoes. So transitioning that was really big for me. One way I do it is, you know, very sustainable, like silk, linen fabrics that can be reused or repurposed a lot. So the first footprint that I have in my life is obviously fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why that's the first place where I focused a lot. So it's pure fabrics, repurposed, restyled after I mm-hmm. use them. And I buy things that are expensive and are of a brand where it will last a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of 20 things from a cheap place that's mm-hmm. going to break every day, two things that are amazing and high quality and last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because my personal footprint, I think the biggest after flights was fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Cosmetics, clothes, everything, skincare.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then I've transitioned my skincare, cosmetics, everything to natural, refillable, things like that. That was a big... And I tried to actually calculate it to the engineer that I am, what it meant to my footprint. And that was a substantial change. I think okay. about 27%. Which is pretty bad. Pretty good, right? One third of my footprint changed by switching over
yeah,
time.
Yeah.
Second place that I think all humans have a big footprint is food.
Mm.
And this is really hard to do. Not everyone wants to be 100% vegan. I get that. But even if you do 20% of your meals right. or 40,
yeah.
that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a daily consumption on the planet,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
It shows mm-hmm. results within months if all of us switched a little bit.
Yeah.
So the food. I think the third biggest footprint is travel, no doubt. So the more you travel, the more you're adding. If you can cut down travel, I think it makes a world of difference. But if you cannot, at least offset it
yeah.
in some way or the other. And last but not least, I think it's our house, how we live, our lifestyle, including festivals. Like,
mm-hmm.
your Christmas is coming up, or there was Durga Puja for Bengalis.
Yeah.
I mean, thousands of things wasted, strewn across the street, people buying idols that are lying everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They have plastic Christmas trees flooding the world.
Yes.
And it really, like, it's great festival. Every festival needs to be enjoyed.
Yeah.
But if you're burning a Monet painting to keep your house warm, that would be really...
Great analogy.
Yeah. Like, I'm burning one eye because I'm feeling so cold. Yeah. And you're like, what? You know? So we're burning the planet to have one more plasticky Christmas or one more Diwali. It would have been okay if the planet had infinite resources, but God, we are dying. Can you stop? So I think, you know, these bursts that happen of festivals and lifestyle, if everybody's listening, can you look at things like, how can I change that? Can I have wrappers that can be reused? Can I have like Japanese style furoshiki? And instead of plastic Christmas tree, can I have a live tree in my house that I water and grows every year? And, you know, if I have to give presents to people, how would I ask them? Sometimes a really nice present that I do a lot. I don't know if my friends aren't telling me the truth. Friends and family, they seem to be pleased. They could go behind my back and say, stingy woman. But like one of the things I do is I would donate in their name to a sustainable cause and then hand them.
That is amazing.
Even if it's £10, if I give it to an elephant reserve or UNESCO or CRY, and then I give them a card that's given in your name. Someone got a school pack because of you. A lot of people are happy instead of just a trash that you didn't even need. And I'm a really big fan of practical presents, like registries, like ask people what they want.
Yes, that's great.
Elephant, a great diamond ring to surprise an engagement. I think in all other circumstances, asking is a really good way to waste, because festivals are a time for waste. And now that we're coming to Christmas, we're going to see wastage everywhere.
Yeah.
So I do try really hard to do all of that. But that being said, the truth is I still live a very sometimes unsustainable life with lots of choices that I don't control, like my kid wanting lots of toys, not always recycling them. You know, all sorts of stuff happens. I'm not entirely pleased with where I am, but I think it's a far cry from where I was as a 20-year-old. So I've made a long journey, and I encourage my friends and family to do that. And I try to bring them on the journey. So I'll like have a party, and then I'll have really nice vegan food, and then I'll hand out the recipes in a printout, or we'll have like a Christmas get together, and I'll give furoshiki to everybody and tell them about it. And my daughter will do a tying ceremony. So then, so I try to bring people on the journey to introduce them.
It's amazing.
But it's really hard to walk into someone's life and say, hey, you guys, you're having a great festival, but look at what you're doing to them. Like, get her out of here. So it's a bit hard. But yeah, I really try to bring people on the journey.
That's awesome. Okay. So one last thing, actually, I wanted you to touch upon, because you talked about the mental space as well in terms of sustainability.
Okay.
And I love that. So if you can touch upon that, that'll be fabulous.
Okay, I will. So one of the ways I think, and this is personal philosophy, so feel free to find a lot of holes in this theory. Having gone through a lot of people that I read, and I mentioned one of the books with you, Silence by Erwin Carroll, and a few others, and Sadhguru from Isha, obviously, that I'm a big fan of, and lots of other people like this. I think I've come to the conclusion that our life reflects very closely how we think and feel. Like our physical space around us reflects who we are. You'll just see that the way you deeply feel starts to reflect around you. I think that all of us take an outstanding amount of footprint in the world because our mental footprint is pretty huge. You know, there's complexity. And I think a large percentage of that is literally because we're not thinking for ourselves. We don't think first principles. It's just like lots of messaging being handed down to us, either generationally or socially or culturally or by friends and family, who are all very different from us. But some of those messages have gone under our skin, and then we are starting to process them together, even though it doesn't suit you. And you have this very complex life. And what that means is, and Living Simply by School of Life, that's another book that I wanted to mention that will actually help, that helped me reduce mental footprint. What helped me make my life simpler is to make my brain simpler and make space in my brain. I think when my mental footprint became simpler and streamlined, my actual life footprint became simpler, because it's really hard to do things artificially every day. You can change the way you celebrate festivals, how you eat, what clothes you wear, who you go to, but it will all feel like a chore. And the day someone's not looking or you're angry, you'll be like, you know, fish it. I'm going to just do everything today. You know, I'm ordering 10 burgers, buying 5 Prada bags, ordering 3 flights. You won't talk to anyone because God's been so unfair. I haven't been promoted. It's almost like someone's supposed to do something for you. And if they don't, then you're going to take it out on the world. I think that's because it's artificial. You're forcing yourself to reduce your footprint. Your mind still has a huge footprint, you know. I think the footprint of mind is, by the way, it's not equal to being stupid. I actually think it's the reverse. It makes you more sophisticated. Exactly. As a thinker.
Because I feel like as a human, we make so many decisions every single day in all the various roles we have. Yeah. So just minimizing a bit of that.
You're way more sophisticated a thinker. And it also, you know, like Zen, that's what they do. They make space in their brain. When you make space within your mind, one of the ways we make space, remember the olden days when we have really old computers, you would have to organize the space by clicking the button and you would just bring it all together.
Yes.
First of all, organization already creates space. So having decisions spread all over your life, it's just a terrible organization. It has a huge footprint. I like to bring everything together. And then suddenly, you know, it's compressed and it's in one place. It already frees up space. The second way to create space is basically chuck out unwanted stuff from the brain. And it's really hard to do. But if you know what is fundamentally valuable for you and what is not, it's really easy to do. Once your mental footprint is a bit lesser, it reflects in your life.
Yeah.
You will have a smaller carbon footprint because you're consuming, acting, doing things, not as much. Whereas if you do it artificially as morality, like, then you'll do it. But like I say, the day you have a fight with your partner, you're going to do five times more because the truth is you actually weren't feeling it. You were forcing it.
Yeah.
I think reducing mental footprint is a big way to, you know, in that way for me, sustainability and spirituality are very connected. They're connected things. If you're able to do one, you might be able to do the other, and the other might lead you to the first one somehow. So I think reducing mental footprint, and the three or four books that I mentioned really help with that. Silence by Erwin, the Walker, he walks to the North Pole a lot. And then
I think you mentioned one more, right? I think you said Flatland.
No, it was Simple, How to Lead a Simple Life by School Life. And then, of course, Sadhguru's either Inner Engineering, the book, or Encountered Enlightened, like, or any, really. I also think that there are a couple of other books written by, you know, a few Buddhist monks that I care about, T. Lobsang Rampa, quite a few people. Basically, you can have your own pick, but if you have these three, they just help you reduce your mental footprint. It's not like a constant diarrhea of thoughts followed by distributed decisions in 500 places in your life. And some of the really, really good entrepreneurs I've met, regardless of whether they were on sustainability or not, they had remarkably streamlined lives. They were like a streamlined torpedo, which is why they were going straight to the end and everyone else is struggling. And I think it's because they put everything, they put all logs in one fire. Now you can say that's a very unhedged, non-de-risk decision, but that's kind of what I think life is. You kind of put all logs in one fire, and if it doesn't work, you still live with the experience. That's what it is. So I think reducing mental footprint is a big part of leading a sustainable life.
That's beautifully said. Now, before we wrap up, let's play a little fun round of spill the tea. How do you like your chai, Jaritha?
That's a really good question.
And do you have a ritual around it?
Yes. So I have two types of chai. One is a very half-heart chai, which is my office chai because I don't have an opportunity. It's like a tea bag, really. I like Earl Grey and I want to dip it for about 30 to 45 seconds. And then it has to have one spoon of unsweetened almond milk and almost zero to no sugar or a tiny drop of honey. Like it has to be a drop. And then I have to have it after it has been sitting there for 1 minute because it can't be too hot. So that's like the opposite. It's half, but like I'm very serious.
Exactly.
Yeah. And there are people in my office, particularly one person who makes it, who's got it wrong a couple of times. And it's just like, I didn't say anything. My face was like, this is not right. but if I make it at home, I like the classic Indian tea. I like to boil it a lot. Put in the bloody leaves. Put in ginger. Put in cinnamon sticks. Put in like, you know, a little bit of cardamom and just boil it. I mean, it's a lot boiled. Then you add milk. I'm more or less vegan. So I try to add unsweetened nut milk. I don't really use oat milk because oat is very high in sugar and I'm mildly diabetic as well. So sadly, I can use only nut milk. And after it's nicely boiled and you add milk, boil a bit more. It's like chai, proper kind of chai.
Yes, yes.
And I'm from Kolkata. And if you ever go there, you have to have our kesar chai.
I actually have been there and I've had
it. Oh my God, you loved it?
And also the classic, I was actually stuck in the Kolkata traffic, which was not going anywhere. Yeah. So I jumped out of the yellow taxi, went to the local guy, had the kullar chai.
Yes.
And I had also had the what do you call it? The puris.
Yes, yes, he'll give you with it. It's amazing. That's it's what the I best snack with it. So unhealthy, but like so amazing. I love that kesar chai when I go to Kolkata. I haven't been some time, but basically that's my style. Mm-hmm. And if I make it at home and have tea for me is like space for myself. Mm. So I would either share it with someone very close to me or I'll have it alone. I'll just sit by the balcony, look out at the church spire through the trees and just have my tea. Mm-hmm. That's like my moment, 15 minutes for myself. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, just tea, just around 3:30. That's the time. I can't have it later. But like, that's like my right time if I'm at home doing that. And if there's someone very close to me who's at home, like my mom is visiting or someone, you know, we'll sit there and we'll have a bit of a chit chat, but not too much. Like it's the moment to enjoy tea.
Yes.
That's like a moment of solace. If I get it even or twice a week, it's like my soul food.
True. I feel you. And do you like a snack pairing with your chai?
Oh, yes. So I like classic Mari biscuit type of situation. Oh. Yes. Yes, I'll do like the Britannia
Dip
Mari
just
biscuit.
Enough because timing matters here.
Timing matters. If it falls through, I am so disappointed. I will fish it out if my finger burns. So I need to not drop it. But I also like namkeen.
Mm.
So if there's like save or like in around Diwali, you get gujia. Basically, just stuff that is not good for you. You know that. But the worse it is, the better it is. But my absolute favorite is kesar chai in a cooler with a terrific samosa.
Oh.
A nice hot samosa and cooler chai. I'm like, man, nothing can beat that date. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's absolute top. It costs 2 rupees, so 10 rupees maybe. But it is the best thing you can ever do in life.
That's awesome. And what does Jovita like to do when she's not working?
What is not working? that's my situation. So I'm constantly reading. That's not something I'm doing when I'm not working. I'm constantly reading. I'm reading in toilets. I'm reading in tubes. I'm reading in airports and stations. So that's not something I do when I'm not working. I do it all the time. I do it before sleeping as well. So that doesn't count. But just mentioning, I'm a voracious reader from the age of 3.5. And from classics to economics to literature to poetry to science, I read everything on this planet like mad. Like I consume it like a ravenous person. And I've done it from a very young age.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do when I specifically find time to do, and this is kind of hard to execute, but again, like my tea, you'll see I'm very specific about how I want to do it. That's why I don't do it often. I like to go to a very natural place and spend time.
Mm-hmm.
So either hours or days, you know. And when I feel completely in tune and calm when I'm there, like I've gone for walks or I've enjoyed the nature because it's in a forest or in a mountain or next to the beach, I've completely become in tune with this place.
Mm-hmm.
Then I become comfortable enough to actually start painting or writing. So I have a very hidden artist side to myself, but that's what I like to do. If I find the time, then I will write, I will paint, but I can't do it the moment I arrive.
Mm.
All the hustle needs to go out of my brain in the next days.
Mm-hmm.
And then something comes out of me, which is very different from what I do in day-to-day life. It's probably the very softer side of me that is normally not very visible as a leader in tech.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the side that comes out when the hard side kind of disappears and subsides. And then I'm a wildly different person. I'm actually way quieter, quite introvert, and I like creating art. I have always said that I'm an artist wrongly born in the body of an engineer. I really do love my art. So that's what I like to do if I do get the time.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for taking this time and sharing your journey and all of your rich experience with our listeners.
Thank you so much, Shweta. Thank you for having me.
And if our listeners, you guys want to learn more about the impactful work Samudra Oceans is doing in the climate tech space, check out their website, samudraoceans.com. I'll be sure to leave the link in our show notes as well. So until next time, everyone, bye.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us for season 4 of the Chai Break podcast. We hope you leave here feeling inspired. To stay connected, follow us on Instagram at chai_break_podcast. Want even more sustainable goodness?
sign up for our monthly newsletter at chaibreakpodcast.substack.com, packed with exclusive content, new episode drops, and more. And don't forget to like, share, and leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Your support means the world to us.